Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
Mega Bears Fan.
So are we ready, steady then?
3, 2, 1, go.
All right, welcome to Polycast episode 403 on the Man Team, joined by Canis Albinus.
Aw. Well, you see, I forgot, again, because I can't remember anything clever on the spot.
Makalua?
We call this the technical difficulties episode, but isn't that a lot of episodes?
Yeah, and Mega Bears Fan.
Yeah, I like to blame it on it being morning here on the West Coast. It's too early for me to be doing this stuff.
It's morning somewhere in the world.
Most of the time. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say it's also 5 o'clock somewhere.
The UK, I think? Because it's 12 o'clock on the East Coast of the U.S.
It's time to have a drink.
Oh.
Nice. Well, okay. That's always true.
Or two.
Speaking of things that give us drinks.
Things that occur when drunk.
Occur when... Did we need more merging in this industry? But anyway, take two as merged with Zynga. Which, why does this say to me we're totally getting a mobile Civ thing somewhere in the near future?
I think we already had one and it didn't work out.
Yeah, but they're probably going to try again, because why not?
But that's only because it wasn't made by Zynga. Unless it was, in which case...
Well, yeah. You got to keep trying, right?
Yeah, and I also guess. $12.7 billion share buyout. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
They're pointing out that that's the Take-Two's one, like, weakness in market as far as gaming is concerned. They didn't have anybody who did anything good mobile, so now they've got Zynga. But it doesn't just include Civ. That includes things like GTA and Bioshock, some of the annual, NBA and some of the annual sports titles. They've got
Red Dead.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, not just Civ, that could end up with
GTA.
Mobile versions of... Yeah, no, I thought I said GTA, but...
You might have, my brain isn't working. But we already knew that.
So expect a lot of franchises you didn't expect to have mobile things near you soon?
Do you guys not have phones?
God. No, sorry, we don't have $1,000 smartphones. Jeez, no.
Hey, Blizzard.
I mean, I don't have anything against using mobile games or making mobile games. I'm not interested in them personally. So as long as they keep normal game development in parallel, I'm not going to complain. If they do stop that, then I won't be happy. But whatever. Life goes on.
We'll just have to switch over to whatever else comes next.
Yeah, I mean, if there's enough people wanting to play some type of game, somebody will start making it eventually. So we'll live with it. But yeah, we'll see.
Worst case hypothetical is that Zynga's mobile design philosophy starts leaching even more into the, console and PC gaming designs. So hopefully that does not happen.
Well, there's some benefit to console because you have limited inputs there too. So it depends how they go about it. With PC, in theory, it shouldn't be a problem, but in practice, I've observed that it just results in UI neglect.
Well,
but there's no reason it has to.
I was talking more about monetization and junk like that. All the wait 24 hours for the next thing to unlock in a game kind of crap.
Oh, that's already been on consoles.
Yeah.
I'm looking at
PC.
I just don't want to see more of it.
I'm looking at you, Dragon Age Inquisition.
It's also on PC. It's already unfortunately common. So
Mass Effect Andromeda, which wasn't as bad as people like to think it is.
Yeah, I brought up Gran Turismo 7, and we were chatting before starting with all their $20 million exotic cars that cost 200 real-world dollars to buy.
Like, I can't imagine that's a good business practice for them, because, nobody ever talks about Gran Turismo anymore, it's only Forza.
Yeah, well, and especially since, it's especially bad when you design your entire monetization scheme around just the whales, because, nobody's buying any of the cheaper. Nobody's using these microtransactions to buy the cheaper stuff because all the rest of the stuff in the game is easily affordable. It's just the super ridiculously expensive stuff right? There's like the $20 million stuff, and then there's the $100,000 stuff, and like very little in between. So it just, it's signed entirely for the whales, which I can't imagine they make that much money off of it, but maybe they do. I don't know.
I've never seen a blue whale playing a mobile game, so I don't know. Orcas maybe, but not blue whales.
If I can just open this darn link. So yeah, this is not a merger of a company, but it is news about another company, which is that Microsoft is announcing a possible competitor to the Civilization franchise. It is called Aura. I'm assuming it's pronounced Aura.
I don't know offhand.
I would imagine.
Which they are calling History Untold Turn-Based Strategy Game.
Grand Strategy Game.
Yes, Grand and Strategy Game.
It says it's created by Firaxis and EA veterans, so we're already off of a great start.
Wow, which Firaxis veterans?
It doesn't say. If I had to take
my opinion somewhat.
If I had to take a wild guess, I would suspect some that have left quite a while ago.
I mean, I doubt it's any of the big names, like the lead designers, since they're all off with their own studios and making their own independent projects.
Yeah, because if one of them had come over, they would have trumpeted that to the
If it was a Soren Johnson or someone like that,
it's clearly not. That.
They don't even mention the name of the studio in the article. But we know that they made Ashes of the Singularity. So if we were going to do the journalist's job for them and properly look up and include the information that was supposed to be in the article, good job, games journalists. You've really done a good job at this one.
Was there even like a trailer or anything? Because
we got a trailer, but we didn't get a good look at what the game play would be.
It was more of a teaser.
Yeah,
just cinematics.
Yeah. Oh, wait, I guess it does tell us Oxide Games, does it? But doesn't tell you who the publisher is. The publisher is Stardock.
Oh, I was assuming the publisher was Microsoft.
Oh, maybe the publisher is Microsoft, and the publisher of Ashes of the Singularity was...
Yeah, that's Stardock. Yeah, they did Ashes.
Look at Oxide Games. Do the job that, you know, was appropriately... supposed to be.
All right.
We can't memorize who works at every single game company.
Yeah, and that's literally not our job. That's your job because you are the journalist.
Now.
Brad Wardell and former Firaxis employees Dan Baker, Mark Meyer, Brian Wade, and Tim Kipp.
Huh. Not a lot of names I recognize, but
I recognize Brad Wardell.
Sure. Yeah.
He was the founder of Stardock. He still is the founder of Stardock. And I believe he's still the CEO of Stardock.
Well, we'll see. And you never know. If they actually do get some sort of mix between Paradox Games and Civ, and it's good, then yes, it will actually be competition.
I will be honest. If there was anybody in the industry I would expect to have a good shot, it's that team. So
yeah.
Because Ashes of the Singularity, while not popular, was pretty good.
The historic turn-based strategy gaming subgenre certainly is starting to get awfully crowded lately.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing, though, because in the past like decade, there has been minimal competition previously, and the quality has suffered for it to a degree. So yeah, it's good to see some coming up.
It is good in that there are more options for people to play, but it is also bad for people like me who have full-time job and kids and other hobbies, because it's going to be really hard to actually play all these darn games. I've gone through the tutorial of Old World so far, but that game's been out for like a month now on Steam, and all I've gotten past is the tutorial, so because I just haven't had time to play it.
Yeah, I've been not doing strategy too much. Well, I've been doing like turn-based tactical strategy like Battle Brothers rather than stuff like this. But I am interested in Old World at some point.
The Oxide Games Wikipedia page is being considered for deletion. Why? It doesn't ever say why. It just says, in accordance with Wikipedia's deletion policy. Well, what does that mean?
Nobody edited it in a couple of years? But then why would you need to delete it?
Or nobody looks at it.
There's like 14 things here. And I'm not going to read them all because we're in the middle of a show. But like it is a company that has released a game and it has achievements. Why are we deleting it?
Maybe somebody didn't like one of the games and tried to get them deleted. I don't know.
Their only game is Ashes of the Singularity.
Well, somebody with a petty grudge is what I'm trying to say.
That could be.
Yeah, I don't really know how Wiki operates. Except for, like, when you get into people battling over, like, a sports person's entry or whatever from different teams, messing with it until they lock that down.
That's funny.
Yeah, it is. It's very amusing.
Sony acted as a burn center for the employees of the Microsoft 2013 E3 presentation. Because that was the year that they announced that the Xbox One was going to be only, was basically not for games at all. And people were like, this is awful. And then Sony just released a trailer of awesome games.
Smooth. So yeah, I mean, we don't have anything else about this new game yet, do we?
Yeah, but I'm looking at the list of topics, and the Senate is before the forum talk, which...
Well, we don't have to do it that way.
That's not supposed to happen. There's a specific order.
You
want to
go to forum talk next weekend?
Next weekend? Oh, next we can. Okay.
Yeah, no. Yeah, all right, guys, pack up. We're gonna continue the show next weekend at the same time. No, that's not what's happening here. Okay, so forum talk.
I didn't know there was a specific order in which the things had to be in.
I don't know
We are truly stacking production problems here.
I don't know if I've ever said that.
We're having a production problem.
I don't know if we're
delivering you a production problem, yo dog.
I don't know if we've ever stated that directly, but it's always been the practice.
All right, well, that's fine. So, yeah, this is a post by Leyran complaining about Civ 6's production issues, which I'm not sure I agree with. Like, I don't think production in Civ 6 is that bad / slow. I do somewhat agree with the issue of district cost scaling, and that's been something of a problem in Civ 6 since it was released.
I think that was the entire point of his post.
Yeah, I mean, there's things you can do, right? Like with trade routes and whatnot to speed it up a bit, or chopping. But it is, yeah. So like you could rearrange like what costs what a bit in Civ 6. I agree with that. That I do.
I mean, I feel like there should be a way to settle cities after the Renaissance that are going to have some districts.
Yeah, and like get them up to speed, because in most cases you would expect new cities to become productive more quickly with better technology rather than more slowly.
Yeah.
Or maybe have just some like later mid to late game policy cards that reduce the cost scaling of districts while that card is in play. So, you know, you can slot in the card that gives you extra population in new cities, and then the one that's, you know, gives you discounts toward districts, and then get those new cities up and running more quickly at the cost of not having economic cards that are benefiting your older, more mature cities as much.
I think that's reasonable, but I also think it's reasonable to just make new cities scale up more quickly with tech in some way. It doesn't have to be like just automatically, but something that lets you get them going. Like you just settle a city and you turn 200, it's going to be faster at baseline than turn 50. And the reason for that is that you want the trade-offs to make sense still as the game progresses. Like, the later you are in the game, the less total benefit you're going to get out of a city just because there's fewer turns remaining. But also, like, you need that to do something for you that is more effective than what you put into it in the first place before you're winning the game, losing the game, whatever. Like, you needed something decisive of value from that city before the game ends. And the later it is, the less likely that becomes.
Yeah. No, so two things. One is usually when I'm founding cities later in the game, it's to get access to a resource, usually a strategic resource, which doesn't require any districts or buildings. It's just send a builder over there to improve the tile. And if I don't do anything else with that city, like whatever, I got the resource that I needed. But also, like, the second point is there are ways to work around this. So, you know, even though there aren't any policies that allow you to discount the cost of districts, there is the governor that lets you buy them with gold. And then I think one of the big things that Firaxis was intending was that you should be using trade routes to boost the production of new cities in the mid to late games in order to get all that stuff built more quickly. Now, does that completely offset the exorbitant cost of late game districts and new cities? Probably not. But, you know, there are things built into the game that are designed to reduce or mitigate that cost in the cases where you do want or need to build a new city and get districts up and running quickly.
I mean, I can build a library on turn 10 with 15 turns of production on a bad day. Why does it have to take 120 turns on turn 200 to do the same thing?
I mean, I guess like at like an abstract level, and again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, like the campus that you build in 3000 BC is, you know, much less technologically advanced than this building a campus in, you know, the year 2000 AD. So the cost is higher, but also like the mechanics of construction are far more advanced. So those should balance each other out.
Yeah, plus you're not making any investments to take your 3000 BC campus and upgrade it forward into something modern, right? So you pay that cheaper cost, and then that ancient stuff is still good forever. And on top of it, it's like you say, like you would expect, like relative to the nations in which constructed them, that it's not even necessarily more expensive to build a campus in modern times than it would have been to produce something similar in ancient times, just because we have better industry generally.
Well, on top of that, the campus itself doesn't have any buildings. So basically, we are clearing an area and planting some trees and making some paths.
Well, it produces science somehow. So it's, there's something there, but it's not really clear what that something is supposed to be throughout the ages.
It's just a telescope like in Elden Ring.
Yeah, it is weird too, because like the districts in Civ 6 don't even like require population to operate them. Like they have population requirements, but all your population is working improvements on the in the countryside and not the actual urban, you know, districts. So like, how is this campus providing science if there's it has no buildings and nobody's working in it? I mean, that is a very good question.
I mean, bring back specialists, please.
I mean, I guess at an abstract level, they could say that it is being worked by a small number of specialized citizens, which is not as many people as you need to work like a farm. So it doesn't count as a full point of population. But again, that's just me trying to make up ad hoc excuses to play devil's advocate, because, you know,
that's a functional abstraction.
I'm very good at making up excuses for things like this.
No, I think that's a reasonable abstraction, because the number of districts you can support is gated on your population. So you would expect that some proportion of that population is not being used as citizens then, but instead towards districts. And that percentage goes, like, the absolute number of those is limited, and thus your district capacity is limited. It's, and we're operating on the scale of, like, you know, dozens to, you know, at least a couple of years a turn in most cases. So I think that's good enough, really. Like, micromanaging that stuff would get annoying. Now, that being said, I would like there to be some reason to use specialists, which isn't really a thing right now, like as a game mechanic, we had in earlier Civ games.
I always kind of assumed that, like, the cities in Civ 6 actually have, like, one more point of population than the UI shows you, but it's just that that is the point of population that, like, lives in the urban center of the city. So,
well, it does produce yields. So
yeah, the population points that are on the UI is the labor, I guess, population, and not like the actual population of the city. But, you know, whatever, that's again just an ad hoc rationalization on my part.
Who goes to the campus is all those fractions of population that can't work in the fields anymore, and the campus just, can y'all go over here and talk your dumb stuff, and then sometimes they come up with a good idea. You know, the old men sitting there just shooting the breeze, or not so old men, and then they somehow come up with neat ideas.
Yeah, just staring at the mountains.
Yeah, hey, what if we did this?
Mountains and jungles are really good and inspirational sources.
What's that big gray cloud on the side of the mountain that's coming at us at an alarming speed?
Whoops.
What are those weird animals with four legs and stuff that, you know, they're not like cows, they don't give us milk. Maybe we could use them for something, I don't know.
I mean, there are comments in this thread, like the, you know, all costs in Civ 6 are too much, for example. But, if you make costs significantly lower, like if you just have everything across the board, you're going to get so many units. I do not want another picture of the Civ 5 Carpet of Doom early on.
I thought that picture was fake, though.
Well, no, you could, on high difficulties, the AI would have, like, units on every tile at some points of Civ 5.
The issue with the AI, in Civ 5, okay, never mind.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, if you, like, make the costs a lot cheaper, like, if you just slash costs across the board in Civ 6, like, you can already produce a lot of units in Civ 6, and the AI even more so with bonuses, although it doesn't for some reason, but in principle. So, like, if you make everything cheaper, well, now all of a sudden, like, even the player can have serious clutter issues. Civ 6 already has clutter issues just because of what we've covered in the past with units sized relative to cities. If you have doubled the number of units because you cut the costs in half, it's not going to get better.
Yeah, there's also, I think, like, compared to previous Civilization games, I think Civ 6 in particular put a lot more emphasis on trying to specialize cities through the district mechanic, because in previous Civ games, and Civ 5 in particular, you just kind of build everything in every city. But I really think that what they were trying to do with Civ 6 was make it so that you build, like, only the infrastructure that is best in that city, which is why they limit how many districts you can build and cap it by population and make them scale up so much as a deterrent to just building everything in every city. Now, whether or not that works out is, you know, a point for debate, but I do wonder if the original poster in this thread is kind of trying to approach the game more like you would in an older Civ game, Civ 5 in particular, where you do have kind of that mentality of you just build everything in every city because you can.
I don't think so. My impression is Laren's a relatively experienced player, and realistically, it has never, in at least not in the past, like, not since Civ 4, and probably not before that either. I don't think it's ever been a good idea in any Civ game to build everything in every city. Like, man, I don't think that's even true in Civ 2 or 3.
In Civ 5, it was kind of true until you got to the late game where there were much more specialized buildings with limited effects. But, like, up through the Renaissance era, you wanted to build just about every non-military building in every city.
Yeah, later in the game,
you know, opportunity costs, though. Like, I bet if you load up a game between, like, players competing against each other in multiplayer, and you look at, you know, any point in time where the outcome of the game is still in doubt, they will not have every building in every city.
Well, no,
somehow I doubt it.
Remember,
because there's opportunity costs to doing that.
Remember, this is Civ 5 when there were only usually four cities in your empire.
Yeah,
so.
That's what I was going to say as well. Like, in Civ 5, you weren't typically building new cities beyond, like, the medieval era anyway, because you hit that global happiness cap and it's impractical to build anymore.
That's true. I forgot that Civ 5 basically decided to make you stop playing at some point, in a sense.
Well, I'm
a little over harsh of a criticism, but it that really frustrated me. The disincentive to compete for land in a 4X strategy game is really brutal. Man,
you were not the only one who was frustrated by it.
Yeah,
I was also frustrated, but I also kind of liked it. I was on the fence.
I mean, it was less, you know, micromanagement for sure.
In my
But you can also, like, have less micromanagement by not playing at all. That's also an option. In fact, you have none then.
In my increasingly premature mental age, it's a lot easier to take care of 5 cities than 25. But
oh, that's also a UI issue, though.
It's also a me issue.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, you could in Civ 4 manage any number of cities faster than could possibly be done in 5.
I think that was
just because you could automate it. It wasn't good automation, but if you wanted to never have that city prompt you again, you could do it. You just say, nope.
Yeah,
the city's done. You just produce whatever. You just sit there building wealth, or you build whatever the heck building you want. You just go, and it would do it.
Yeah, I think in the previous games, like, you could tell your, you know, your quote abstract governor in the city to just, like, focus on certain things. And I think not only would they do the city projects that just build that yield directly, but I think they would also prioritize building whatever buildings were, you know, flavored for that particular thing that you told it to focus on. And there's nothing even comparable to that in Civ 6. Like, you have to specifically tell every city what to do all the time.
Yeah.
Even now that there's a friggin' governor object in the game that you assign to cities, you still can't let that governor run the city. You still have to tell the city what to do.
You also can't, like, just select all the cities at once and tell all the cities at once to do something, or shift-click a bunch of cities and tell them to do something.
You can, I think, shift-click in the build queue, and it will add whatever you click.
No, I'm talking about shift-clicking the cities. Oh. As in, you select 10 cities, and you tell these specific 10 cities to build a unit. You cannot do that in Civ 6, to my knowledge.
No, you can shift-click to have every city add something to its build queue, but you can't, like, click what specific cities you want to do that to. That is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
It would be pretty funny if we've been complaining about these UI problems for going on 10 years now, and it turns out they were there all along.
Well, the shift-clicking for the queue
has added some.
Yeah, well, yeah. For one thing, the queue in Civ 6, I don't even think was added until the second expansion.
No, it was
or
not.
Or after correct. the second expansion.
It was not there initially.
And I don't think we had the shift-clicking in that queue until, like, a later patch or possibly until the New Frontiers DLC started coming out. I don't remember exactly when it came out, but it was not there from the beginning for sure.
Yeah. There's a few other things, too. Like, you can't, like, to my knowledge, you still can't sort cities by certain factors and then like only select that subset of cities and stuff, which is again stuff you could do previously, and all these things influence the speed at which you can interact with cities. But also, like you said, there's just no means of saying I don't want to look at the city anymore. You just build whatever you want.
I think another thing,
and even you can't even loop a project.
I think
you can queue up a lot though, so that's helpful.
I think another thing that would help in the specific case of Civilization VI would be if there were just more buildings that you could build in the city center, like beyond just a monument and a water mill, and eventually you can build a sewer. But like, that's it. There's three buildings in the entire game that go in the city center. So if you're not building districts, you very quickly run out of things to build. And if there were more things you could put in the city center, then at least you wouldn't have to build, you know, necessarily districts, at least not as often.
I don't think that's as much of an issue, though. Like, I understand it from a design perspective. And if the UI were fine, like, it wouldn't be prohibitive to play around it. I know they wanted to emphasize the districts a lot. It was the first time we had districts implemented this way. And, like, yeah, once they're up, you can then build the buildings of the districts. But you can also just, like, build projects for the districts you have. So, like, in terms of that, like, I get where you're coming from a design perspective. You might prefer more things in the city center versus not or whatever. But from a UI perspective, I don't think it matters.
Well, I mean, yes, you can assign the city to work on district projects, but that does require you to have that first district in order to do a project, because there's also no default project that you can just have the city center do. So if that first district is prohibitively expensive, then you build your monument, you build your water mill, you know, in 10 turns or 15 turns or however the heck long it takes. But then if a district is 150 turns to build, and I have seen district costs that look like that are over 100 turns to build, and you know, you're settling this city in like the Renaissance or industrial era, there's literally just nothing else you can do in that city other than maybe like start popping out the cheapest units that are available.
Although we're getting back to the other topic rather than what Candace was talking about, because if you have a 150 turn build item in your queue, you probably don't have to worry about that city for a while.
That's true. It is also one way to eliminate the micro management.
Yeah, I'll check back at the end of the game to see if you're ready for new projects. But I do wish that, I know we have to scale the districts so you're not getting super cheap districts later on, but it does feel like you can't get any good development, even the lesser development you'd have for a lesser amount of turns, out of a city because of the way the district costs are later on. It's like they're accelerating it, like they're adding to it each era, but then there's also each district in the city is more expensive, and then it's like each district full on is more expensive. It's like they've piled on too much of a creep in the district cost. It's like if you could scale it back just a little bit, it would still be rough to make a full city, but it wouldn't feel so discouraging to even try.
You know, yeah. I'm more sold now on what Leyran's saying, though. Like, you should just leave the districts cheap. It's the advanced buildings that could be made more expensive.
So the reason I think that Firaxis did the cost, because one of the other things that goes into the cost scaling of the districts is that the cost of a particular type of district scales up based on the number of that district that you have in your own empire. And then I think it also scales down based on like the average number of that districts that all the other civs have, like compared to you. So it's also a rubber banding mechanic. The idea, I think, in part is so that one civ can't just build all of the campuses dirt cheap and then claim all of the great scientists for the entire game, which is already still a problem in Civ 6, where, you know, one civ in particular tends to get most of the great people of a particular type because they have more of that district than everyone else. And then also the idea is to try to make it cheaper for civs that don't have that district to get those districts online in order to start catching up in that particular guild, and also to hopefully compete for great people. So I think that's a big part of their reasoning for why they did that. Again, we can argue till the cows come home about whether or not that's the right way to do it.
I'm actually fine with that, though. What bothers me is the tech progression scaling up the cost as well. Like, I see, you could have a relatively cheap baseline district cost and then have it like get increasingly punitive as you make, like, you know, 8 of the same thing or whatever. And then, like, you're still not necessarily going to be choked if you're trying to stand up a new city late game then. Because you can actually get a district down and get some of the early buildings down and have it, like, snowball up into something productive in a reasonable time frame, especially if you're using trade routes and whatever as well. But the base cost of the district going up is just kind of, like, from tech alone, is just weird. Because the buildings inside it don't. It's even a bit of an internal inconsistency in that way. Whereas, like, having it scale based on other people making the districts or based on you having so many already, not necessarily.
Yeah, again, I think that's justifiable from a, you know, from Firaxis's point of view, again, playing devil's advocate here, as a sort of rubber banding thing, because you would assume that the
civs... Oh, no, I wasn't disagreeing with that.
Yeah, the civs the furthest ahead in tech and civics are the ones who probably already have good cities with good districts.
Oh.
So you want the civs that are behind to have an easier time building things in order to hopefully catch up and remain competitive.
Yeah, actually, I don't. I think that's bad. I want the civs that are ahead to be able to leverage that advantage and win or lose.
Well, I don't think any of us are arguing that being behind in tech and having quicker, being able to build districts more quickly gives the behind civs an overwhelming advantage. The civs that are doing better still have the advantage. It's just, you know, hopefully we can at least keep things competitive. And I'm not passing a value judgment. I'm just saying I think that's Firaxis's justification for this stuff.
Yeah, maybe. I just, Civ has so long had an issue with ending games that are over already. And this kind of thing doesn't help. But perhaps that is a philosophical / preference difference in that case. But man, has that been a glaring issue in Civ for a long time. So I don't know if we want rubber banding as opposed to just ending games. Go back to equal when you start a new game, that's for sure.
Quality is overrated?
I mean, only one Civ wins the game, ultimately. Or one team, one or the other.
Well, so that's also like something performing better. That's also something I wish would change, but that's a totally different subject for another day.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you're going to have a competitive environment, though, like in that case, rather than extending the length of the game, I would rather just see them have a means to end a game that's decided.
Oh, no, I meant I would like to see coalition victories where it's not just one civ, but, you know, you can maybe win the game with your very close allies as well.
Well, I mean, that's a theme then. You can have, they had permanent alliances in Civ 4, for example, and you have teams in Civ 6. You could just add something like permanent alliances into Civ 6, and it wouldn't change the game that much if you want.
But again, it's a totally different subject for another day.
I suspect that with current events going as the way they are, there will probably be a faction system in Civ 7. But
I would
hopefully
not
it works just like Hearts of Iron.
Oh, please, no.
just for the record, listeners, I'm not serious about that. Hearts of Iron's faction system can die in a fire, along with its peace conference and war score systems.
I mean, Hearts of Iron 4 in general, just, it's like 60% a good game, and then 40% horrible abomination that should never have left the developer's kitchen.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive in a way, but it's frequently not a good way.
Well,
but there are
like
really fun elements to it too. So
it's like
that's what makes the crappy things about it all the more frustrating.
It's like you can literally fight a war almost by yourself and win, and still get nothing out of the peace deal. It's that bad.
Yeah. Or if you know how to game the system, you can have Brazil and attack Argentina with Brazil, put Argentina into the Axis. Because you declared on Germany as well, so the Argentina as the AI will reliably join the Axis in that scenario. And then you can score farm using Argentina's capital and take everything from World War II out of the nose of allies and the Soviets. And yeah. I don't know, I can't imagine what that world would look like, how confused everyone would be as Brazil, who never left their continent, takes over like a huge percentage of Europe.
Now the Axis of Brazil. What?
Oh, you can be any alignment you want. Doesn't even matter.
Usually in that situation, you'd be non-aligned, though.
Yeah, or you could just be fascist and declare on the Axis anyway. The game doesn't stop you.
And then
the game strongly incentivizes fascism. It is easily the best ideology in Hearts of Iron.
Ahistorical things are a different topic.
Yeah, but my point is, like, there is something wrong with your score system if conquering Argentina means you can take all of Germany and Italy while a different faction is occupying Germany and Italy. There's something not right about that. Like, clearly not right about that. But that's how it is in Hearts of Iron. So, yeah, like, every once in a while people ratio me for pointing out how garbage that system is. But that just illustrates the extreme versions of why it's a broken system by design.
I mean, if you get ratioed for telling you the truth, what does that mean? It means nothing, because the internet
means
you're
saying fanboys.
It means the internet is full of people who think they know better.
Well, that's always going to be true.
I mean, has the internet not been full of people who thought they knew better? I mean,
Dunning and Kruger have a lot to say about that.
Yeah. You know what else people have a lot to say about that? Things that should be in Civ 7 from Civ 6.
Oof. Yeah, let's do it.
Yep. Article over on Game Rant. Literally a title. Features that Civilization 7 should take from Civ 6. So one of the first things, we were just talking about districts. Hey, expand the city districts feature.
I disagree.
What do they mean by expand?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out.
This is not a, this is once again a games journalist article. So it contains about 30% of a thought, and the rest of it is mostly just verbal diarrhea designed to fill in the fact that they don't know what they're talking about.
I mean,
at least see what they're advocating.
I really doubt that districts are going to not be in Civ 7.
Right.
Like, I think that's a feature that is definitely here to stay, at least for the next few entries in the series. But I also am very skeptical that they will work the same way that they worked in Civ 6, because there were a lot of justifiable criticisms about how they worked in Civ 6. And other games in this genre are doing different things with them as well.
So what they kind of want here with this one, I found it, is that they want the districts themselves to produce the units, not the main city. It would be a slower rate. It would be slower to do it, but you could do it alongside the city. Like, you could be working on something else in the city and use the encampment to slowly build units.
So, like, each district has its own build queue?
Apparently.
What would you do in... So I guess, like, your campus district would have its own build queue for building, like, libraries and universities and stuff that, but then, like, there's only, like, 3 or 4 buildings in each district, so, like, are they going to take 100 turns to build?
Presumably, they would want more buildings/things available.
Yeah,
I don't see the benefit of this in the current district model. Like, I don't think putting this into Civ 6 as Civ 6 is now would make any sense at all.
Well, I mean, and also, it's like, it completely, that would take all the choices out of the game, because every district would just queue up the next available building in that district type, and then you just wait 50 to 100 turns for it to be done, and then queue up the next building. There's no choices about, you know, which building do I want to build, which is more important to me, because they're all getting built simultaneously.
Literally.
Well, yeah. You
go ahead. Go ahead, Maggie.
Separate from the main city. I mean, you could still do. That's true. They only come in you have to build the library before you build the other thing, and I guess in between, when they're not building something, they're producing more science, like when you do this. At the bottom, we have it where they try to produce the extra great person points or something like that, except they're actually producing maybe just literally more science or more faith if it was a religious district. I mean, I see sort of that with I see where they're going with the encampment. I kind of see where they're going in the sense of a holy site, because you could have it produce the missionaries and prophets and whatever while your main city kept to its normal thing.
Yeah, there's a few districts for which this would work. Yeah, the military districts for sure. Your markets and harbors building trade units, like, that could work. Your religious districts building religious units, like, that could work too. But again, like, what does a theater district or a campus district build?
I'm not sure it works even for the previous ones. Like, one of the important things about Civ games is that you're choosing what you're producing as a trade-off.
Right, which is what I was saying.
It would require a full restructure of the entire concept of the gameplay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you would need a lot more building options, a lot more unit options, probably a lot more, like, district project options. Like, maybe instead of there just being one, you know, project in the campus that builds science, there's maybe, like, different options for generating science in different ways. I don't know.
It almost sounds like more of a system that would work better in a game like Humankind, because in that game, units aren't one unit per tile. And in Civ, you can't really have a building that auto-produces units because there's a limited number of squares on the map, or hexes on the map, or whatever.
Yeah, in Humankind, you also build multiple copies of the same type of district as well. So hypothetically, in that game, like all of the districts of a single type that you built could be contributing towards that joint construction queue.
It just seems like they're trying to turn, or that idea turns Civ into a mobile style, oh, wait for the timer to go off until you get your next unit.
Oh boy, callback. Wonderful. Yeah.
Which, I mean,
it's exactly the kind of thing that I said at the start of the episode that I'm afraid of seeing in our games.
It kind of already has that. It kind of already has that because you do produce a unit, but it's not like, oh, well, I can be doing other things while I'm producing this unit. No, it's you're producing the unit. That's what you're doing. And everything else is on hold while you build this unit.
Right, and I'm producing that unit at the expense of not being able to build anything else in that city unless I'm, like, gold buying them or something like that. So it's not just like I have 100 timers that I'm waiting to go off, you know, before I can do anything.
This isn't Star Trek the game or whatever it was. What was the name of that? Which was it, Star Trek the mobile game, where you would do the things and then you would have a timer? Unlock the next timer to do the next thing?
I played that for a little bit. Trexels, right? You're talking about that pixel art game?
I think it was, but I don't remember it being called Trexels. All I remember is it was an abomination of a game that never should have been made and should have been put on trial at the Hague, basically.
Yeah, it was bad.
Actually, we need our own city for crimes against gamers.
This article would also be a lot easier to read if not for the fact that every time I scroll up or down on it, it like reloads all of the ads and like everything on the page like moves up and down. It has to reformat the whole dang page every time I scroll up.
Well, the good news is these articles are actually so vapid that they'll be written by AI in a few years and they won't have to pay all those people.
Yeah, just like sports box scores.
What's next? Yeah, develop barbarian clans more, by which they mean let them turn into a proper civ, not just a city-state.
I know we've talked about Civ 4's minor civilizations before. I think you get something like that again.
Yeah, or even you just change the current city-states that after a certain point, maybe they could actually use that settler they captured. Yeah, but they point that would give... They were thinking like that gives the player more incentive to go get the barbarians. No, I have plenty of incentive to go get the barbarians already. They're annoying as heck.
Yeah,
I don't need it.
Go ahead.
Plus, they're a source of resources if you go for them.
Yay, gold.
Yeah.
And they're a score, too.
And even their idea is, but you could stay on their good side after they become a city-state, and you could have a potential ally. It's like, we have a mechanic for that already.
Well, and I think they're also specifically talking about the Barbarian Clans game mode that was in New Frontiers Pass, mm-hmm. in which you actually could, like, bribe the barbarians to go harass someone else and stuff like that. And that stuff, I will say, that stuff was really good. I do think that is a very good, first step towards making the barbarians, like, a more interesting and, you know, hopefully more humanized faction within the game so that they don't come off as just being, like, mindless automaton wildlife. Because ostensibly they are people too and should kind of be treated as such.
Well, at least it's not like it was back in Civ 4, where if you left the barbarians alone, they would settle Native American cities.
Yeah, well, in Civ 4, they also like had wildlife units, like wolves and bears, and they had the same, they were considered the same faction as the barbarians. So the barbarians in Civ 4 were technically
these people wildlife. Are animals.
I think it was more that the animals were considered barbarians than the other way around. But
true, but still, like, the implication goes either way.
Because the animals were gone fairly quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's right, because they turned into barbarians, Animorph style.
Oh, yeah, no.
If that Barbarian Clans mode from New Frontier Pass was actually the default in the next game, that wouldn't be bad, because as long as you can still turn it off, because I know a lot of people don't like playing with barbarians, so... But the way that that's set up, I like it, because sometimes the barbarian clans would pop up like way in the north in some icy spot and it's terrible, and but they'd still be attacking you. But in this way, they eventually turn into city states. So Also, they're colonizing a spot that the AI won't, so you're not chasing down that one AI city in an ice tundra heck area, you know?
Yeah, the pitch I keep making for what I would like to see happen with barbarians is I would like to see them actually treated more like essentially the equivalent of nomadic city-states, where each one is a tribe and you can actually do a certain degree of diplomacy with them, and there are benefits to allying with them. Like maybe they, you know, as nomads, they travel through other civs' territory and maybe they work the tiles that they're on if you're friendly with them, so you get more yield from them or something like that. Or if you're hostile, then they start pillaging things.
Or we could have those be a playable civ type. I know we've talked about that before, too.
Yes, yeah, as well. And if those are basically the city-state equivalent of nomadic civilizations, fully playable nomadic civilizations, that would also be something I would like to see, assuming Phyraxis can find a way to make that work.
Well, I mean, Paradox found, like, three ways to make it work and then changed each one of them because it was too good.
And so did Creative Assembly with the Total War Attila game, which also had nomadic civilizations.
The problem is those games have provinces.
Correct.
And Civ does not have provinces. It has tiles.
Yeah. Although you could designate sets of tiles as provinces on your random generation if you want.
That also is exactly what humankind does.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has pros and cons. I mean, one of the pros is that there's less city spam and there is more open countryside for having, like, you know, field battles during wars and stuff like that. So, like, that's nice. I would like to see Civ give more incentive to not build every city three tiles apart from one another. But yeah, it is frustrating when it's like, oh, I really want to leverage this part of the map, but I can't because I already have a city in that zone. Although later in the game, you actually do unlock the ability to create, like, little satellite villages that do allow you to make, like, mini cities in the same region. So, you know, there are also in that game ways around those limitations.
I do like the way that the game basically makes organizations like Dallas and Fort Worth impossible, because you can't have two big cities in the same province.
No, but you could build them literally adjacent to each other as long as they're on the border of the provinces.
Well, by the scale of humankind, Texas would be in a province into itself, and we have four large cities in one province, so hold up.
Well, that's going to be true pretty much everywhere, though, because the maps are scaled down in size so that they're playable.
From where I live, Texas doesn't have four big cities. It has, like, 10 big cities. Because, well, for us, 100,000 people is a big city.
How many provinces in France in, like, one of those Total War games? I'm sure there are more big cities in France than there are provinces in any of the Total War games.
I mean, it depends on the specific game, because some of them have larger and smaller scales to them. But yeah, like, for example, Empire Total War, like, Britain is one province. Because that game actually had a global scale to
it.
Yeah.
I remember that game. I tried to play it again recently. The interface is so awful. Like, the mouse controls are so finicky. It's like we've come a long way.
And I should say five cities. I should include San Antonio. It's gotten really big. I keep forgetting.
Wait, what were the four big ones before San Antonio?
Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, and Austin.
Is Dallas really a city, though?
Yes, it is. Yes. I've been there. It's huge.
Man.
It's a concrete jungle, and I live in it.
So Dallas, big. Dallas is
but
such
a... Cowboys there.
No, that's Fort Worth.
Dallas is actually so big that it makes every city in my state look tiny. And we have a city the size of a freaking county.
They're not called the Fort Worth Cowboys, Maggie.
They should be. There's only urban cowboys over here. Anyway. Okay, one thing they did want to keep was the current envoy system and the way the government features work with the cards. They're just like, add some more new stuff, which, yeah, even us have been playing it. Yeah, can we have some more new cards? Because we have some that it just makes sense that we always slot those in and there should be some better alternatives, you know.
Like the aforementioned reduce the cost scaling of districts card that I proposed earlier for the previous topic.
I disagree wholeheartedly with this particular suggestion. I think the government system sucks, and I want the Civ 5 city-state system back.
Yikes. I mean, the Civ 5 city-state system is maybe better in some ways and worse than others than Civ 5, but the government system of Civ 6 sucks outright. Yeah.
Well, because you have so little choice. Like, you have a bunch of these government policy cards, like, big whoop, I'm a bad player.
There are trade-offs to both the timing of it and what you're slotting in as a choice. Like, I think it has more nuance to it than Civ 4, and Civ 4 is the next best competitor when it comes to managing.
I'll be honest about this. My dislike of the government system lies totally on my bad working memory, because I cannot keep the number of cards that there are possibilities in my head long enough to make a decision that actually works. Because if I'm trying to make a decision about, like, what does my empire really need, there are too many variables that have to be held in my brain while going to the other screen and switching things out, that in between the switch, my brain just loses like 80% of them, and then it's like, okay, this sounds good.
I feel like that would be an issue with any sufficiently complex system, though. Like, wouldn't you similarly struggle with Worker Micro and Civ 4 then? Because you'd have to sequence
what you're improving based on priorities.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't play at a high level.
Yeah, I think part of that, Canis, could be fixed if the policies and government screen in Civ 6 had, like, a preview of how the particular combination of cards would affect your, like, yields and stuff like that.
There's a mod that does that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just good UI generally. There's no reason to force the player to do math repeatedly when it could be, it's a calculatable thing.
Oh, I wasn't even going into the math. I was literally...
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, in any game, like, unless math is part of the game itself, making people go through the hoops of doing the math repeatedly or having, like, a heuristic memory of it is just a pain. It's busy work in what you really should be doing is trying to evaluate the trade-offs and decide which one gives you the best chance to win. People to do mundane crap repeatedly, like doing the calculations, as opposed to just displaying the consequences of your choices, is generally bad UI, and it is a good practice generally to show the consequences of your choices.
It would also possibly be nice to have maybe some kind of a civic automation system where, like, you can pick from various yield focuses, and then it automatically populates your government with the cards that are going to give you the most amount of that particular yield. So say you're playing a religious civ and you want to maximize your faith output. You click the faith optimize button. It'll automatically slot in all of the, you know, civics that generate the most faith. And then, you know, you don't have to do that yourself. You just, you know, maybe you can change them out from there if you want to further customize it. But it's just like, yeah, give me all the faith you can, and then it'll just do it. And
yeah, it'll just give you some clicks.
Yeah, you don't have to go through like that all of the civic cards. And that would probably also help Canis, because he could be like, all right, well, what does my empire need? I need more science. Give me all of the science you can, civics.
Yeah, I'm well aware that as a brain-damaged person attempting to play a 4X strategy game, the game is not built for me, and I just need to accept that, but I still don't like it.
Well, you should definitely, I think, be very active on, like, the forums and stuff like that with these sorts of issues, because a lot of game development studios are putting a large amount of attention lately, these past few years, on accessibility. You know, like, we have games like The Last of Us Part 2 that had like a whole friggin' option screen of things like color coding the player characters and the enemies for people who are vision impaired, and all kinds of different audio settings for people who are audio impaired, different ways of handling controller inputs for people who have motor disabilities. So, you know, yeah, definitely bring these things up to them so that they are aware of them, and, you know, propose ideas for what you think might help you. Because these companies are really trying to make accessibility a big part of their game designs right now.
What I think
this would help everyone, literally everyone. There's no good reason not to have good UI. But yeah, I mean, certainly improving accessibility it should be a priority as well.
What I do...
And by that I mean, like, accessing the information of the game. I don't mean, like, we need to make the game easier for people. No, just make playing the game less of a chore so that the parts of it that are enjoyable are accessible.
Maybe just a little thing on the side of the card that says this will affect X of your cities.
No, I like Jason's suggestion where you see the consequences of what you're putting in on that screen.
I mean, then you can do both.
Move in cards and move out cards and look at the yields of that and decide what's best for you just by looking at the consequences directly.
Yeah, there could be both. There could be a tooltip that pops up on the cards themselves that say this will change your, you know, yields by this much, or this will affect your cities in this way. And then also, after you've slotted everything in, before saving them and committing to them, there could be a little preview button that shows you, like, the entire, like, economy overview screen of
and
all the differences in all the yields for all the cities that would make.
It just has to be like a line at the bottom or at the top that shows this will change your empire by this much science, this much faith, this much gold, this much culture, whatever, and show it as plus or minus. You're going to lose a little bit per turn. You're going to gain some of this per turn.
Yeah. And Civ 6 already has an economic overview panel that lists all of your cities and what all their yields are. So all I'm saying is that you make that accessible from within the civics and government screen and have it show the plus and minuses for what your current yields are and then what the new yields would be with these policies.
That's it. The way to solve it. Dual monitor usefulness. That way you can look at one thing on one monitor and then your window on another monitor and you're like, okay, I can see what I'm doing because I can look over here and look at the actual game. I'm well aware that I need help like that, but I don't like to accept it. So don't listen to my opinion on that particular topic because it is biased.
But you're absolutely right that the
game your bias should, behind requesting good UI, and then you're good.
The game should absolutely have better UI for displaying that sort of information because I, you know, I don't have the same cognitive impairments, but I have trouble with some of that stuff too. Like, is it better to get, you know, for example, there's like the policies where you get like more science from science adjacency yields from your campuses or more yields from the buildings. And it's like, well, which of these is going to be better? In order to figure that out, I would have to close the civic screen, go to the map, count up all of my campus districts and what their yield, their adjacency bonuses are, figure out what they would be when they're doubled, and then look at all the buildings and count up their yields and what those would be if they're changed, and then compare the two in my head. Like, you shouldn't the player shouldn't have to do that. The game should do that. This is why computers were invented, in order to do these sorts of things.
Well, on the city-states, it's not based on that. The reason I don't like the current city-state system is because they are the mission system is extremely I don't like it. It's like
I'm in full agreement with you on this one.
It's like
missions. We could go back to Civ 5 for missions.
Like I like the Civ 5 city-state system because it wasn't just like this city-state belongs with me forever and forever and ever. And also, if the enemy, like, coups you, you lose all your envoys, which you can't get back ever. So it's like, well, that's just great. It's a large investment that's gone because of a dice roll. Now, it's true that you could have that happen with a monetary investment in Civ 5, but money is easily replaceable. It's not like you can't get more money to buy your influence back.
You only have so many opportunities for getting envoys.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do like that that Civ 6 separated the relationships with the city states from just being gold investment. Like, I like that. I just don't know if the envoy system is like a strict improvement because there's still it's better in some ways. It's worse than in other ways, like you just said.
In a game,
although
like,
there's something to be said for having an economic victory in the game, and that's functionally what getting the city-states all back you was in Civ 5.
I would say that dealing with the game in Civ 6, the Civ 5 city-state system would have problems because money is much easier to get in Civ 6 than it is in Civ 5.
Yeah, that would also be a problem. Alliances with city-states would be pretty trivial for the player in Civ 6.
But you could also solve that by just making the gold costs scale with the era. But then
again, also having to spend that gold on city-state relationships would be a sink for gold, which would reduce the amount of total gold that the player has on hand for other things. So maybe that actually would be helpful in Civ 6.
Considering that very often the game you end the game with like 10,000 gold in the treasury, that could be a good way to use it.
Yeah, it's something else to do with them, something else to think about. So it's not just stockpiling in your treasury with you having nothing to do for it. And then also making those tough decisions of, well, do I want to buy this district or do I want to, you know, bribe this city state?
You want to buy an artillery army and capture the city state.
And the Barbarians clan thing helped with that, too, because you pay money to bribe the Barbarians in the New Frontiers clans mode. So that's also something to do with your gold. The problem with that mechanic is that the Barbarians are all in the early game when gold is at much more of a premium, and then you still don't have much to spend it on in the late game because all the Barbarians are gone by that point.
That's not my experience, but I'm also a bad player.
well, the barbarians aren't as active a nuisance in the late game as they are in the early game. In the later game, you probably don't need to be spending large sums of money on bribing the barbarians to not attack your cities or to harass other people.
Well, yeah, they're usually out just messing around in the ocean, and I said,
maybe they're sinking some of your caravels or knocking out one of your, you know, ocean trade vessels every now and then. You got to go send a frigate or a privateer or something out to deal with them, but they're not like pillaging all the tiles in your cities until you bribe them to go away, the way they are at the beginning of the game.
I think we've got one more option.
Yeah, well, there's two here. One of them was to make industries more in depth, but they don't say how. They just give them more control over the inner workings of the industry. Okay.
Which I don't think fits the scope of Civ.
Well, no, he's talking about the monopolies and corporations' power, which, I mean, I think it's fine. It would be really nice if the AI could use it without stopping the improvement of any land tiles in the game whatsoever, but, you know...
Yeah, I stopped using it because of that bug. I have no idea if that's been fixed yet.
Of course not. There hasn't been a patch.
Yeah, stupid, and the other thing was do more with natural disasters. I know. First off, they're like, can we add tsunamis and stuff? And they said add tornadoes, but tornadoes are already in the game. It's like a cell of spawns tornadoes that goes across everything. And they want it to be even worse with the climate change levels. Like, they want you to be literally verging on disaster when you're trying to go for the science victory. But that's not necessarily under control of the human player, how it's going, because the AI will sit there and pollute like crazy. AI does not care.
Yeah. No. I mean, disasters are already in Civ 6 way more impactful on empires than they were historically by a margin. And they are some of the things in the game with the least agency on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see why we need less agency on something that's already bordering fantasy mechanic.
Well, yes, but they also give you benefits if you manage it right, the thing.
Sure, but again, it's a fantasy mechanic already. And so, like, doing more with the fantasy mechanic and emphasizing them to a degree, like, you might as well have magic at that point. In fact, you could just call them magic disasters or something, and it wouldn't change a whole lot about how they play. Now, like, maybe somebody wants that in Civ. That's fine to want that, but I don't think it fits the Civ gameplay as it's designed now. So unless you're making Civ 7 a different game, like, different type of game, I don't agree with this at all.
I can see the abstraction.
Earthquakes were pretty devastating disasters, and those are not represented in Civ 6 at all.
Somewhat, because they're not climate-related.
Really on the scale of, like, 60 years. Or something.
Well, neither volcanoes aren't really climate related either, other than the fact
they absolutely are climate related. And
well,
if you don't...
it's caused by the climate, though. They affect the climate, but they don't affect the climate in Civ 6. So,
we have all these volcanoes going off in the early age. Why isn't it already turning up the climate change level then?
Well, because
it would do the opposite. It would be cooling.
Yeah, because volcanoes actually cool the climate. Like, right around the Plague of Justinian, we have records of 2 or 3 fairly large eruption events, and we're not exactly sure where in the world they happened, but they caused a 200-year ice age. So, volcanoes are pretty impressive and do, in fact, affect the land for a long time.
They are arguably the most impactful, like, more so than hurricanes, way more so than tornadoes, way more so than earthquakes. Yeah, if you're going to have one that's significant on the time frame of Civ, that would be the one to use, actually.
I will say, though, that I do agree to an extent that I think the global warming thing could maybe go a little bit further, because the fact that you can just hand wave that at the end of the game and not even worry about it and just power to a victory without dealing with it at all, I do think that is kind of a problem, and I would like to see, like, maybe dealing with climate change actually be part of the victory condition, so that you don't just, you know, win and preside over this flooded, hot, desertified wasteland of a world, because that's a situation where nobody wins.
Yeah, but we need
The thing is, though, like, what does that look like mechanically? Because either you're effing off into space, in which case having climate change bother you probably doesn't make much sense, because you're not in the climate any longer. Or if you conquer literally everybody else, like, I guess you can spend a few turns trying to shore up climate change or whatever at the end, but
and that stuff
everyone else is gone, so it's not going to be very interesting to interact with.
It's also so late in the game, and this stuff would almost be future tech, or just past our modern tech for some of the stuff we need to deal with that.
It's
so,
already future
also
tech.
Also, the current issue that the game is usually decided in practice long before climate change is a factor in the game, because usually you know who's going to win before the industrial era begins, let alone like before it is having any impact on the climate.
I think volcanic ice ages and things like that, things that last multiple decades or multiple centuries, you can add those. Those are fine. But we don't need anything at the end of the game, because the stuff at the end of the game is already almost fantasy level to begin with. Not like the climate change part, but the there's no way that climate change is going to make the ocean rise by 3 meters in the next 100 years. Like, not going to happen. But
but there is desertification and stuff like that as well that Civ 6 didn't model at all.
Yeah,
that's OSHA. We should bring back random tiles turning into desert.
Oh,
with,
God.
With like no pattern, rhyme, or reason to have the actual world climate would look.
Desertification.
Just, like, have a desert appear in the middle of France, but like surrounded by not desert still, lol.
My knowledge of desertification is dated to like mid-2000s, so I don't know if this is still the only way that I know of, but the most of the desertification that happens is at the south edge of the Sahara, where the sand is just blowing into the lush area and drowning it. Now, I don't know if that's the only way that can happen, but at the time that I learned about it, that's where it was happening the most. And I don't think that's related.
Well, like extended, droughts that, turn what used to be fairly moderate, climates into borderline desert-like. I live in Las Vegas. We are painfully aware of how, all of Southern California is becoming more and more like desert.
I don't know about Southern California, but there are parts of the world that are getting more arid.
Yeah, one of the effects of climate change is that wet places tend to get wetter and dry places will tend to get drier. So it's not like you're going to have, tropical rainforests turning into deserts, but, the range of existing deserts will expand because the areas around them are going to, fall under that threshold of, what is it, like 2 inches a year of rainfall or something like that is the cutoff point for technically being considered a desert.
Yeah, but if you're getting 2.1 inches of rain per year, you're already effectively a desert anyway, so I don't
right.
know.
We're
not here to argue climate change, because I think we both agree that it's a problem, but, we're talking about Civ, so.
Yeah.
It's also much harder to predict in real life than it can be modeled in a game.
But too,
like, if you sufficiently damage the climate enough to like interrupt the Gulf Stream, for example, the impacts of that will be far and wide. And I don't think there's a person alive that could properly model everything, all the consequences of that accurately.
Yeah.
But in the game, we just need to know which provinces are going to flood or which tiles are going to flood or whatever. Like, we're not trying to do that kind of advanced stuff. Again, that kind of math / calculation / modeling is appropriate, but not in a game of Civilization where we're trying to optimize for our empire growth in a 4X. We're not trying to like do crazy stuff.
We're not trying to save the world. We're just trying to emulate it.
Yeah, and poorly, because we are mostly trying to play a game rather than model the reality. Modeling reality is secondary to the gameplay trade-offs.
Huh. The stream is being very sluggish in its response. I clicked stop streaming, and it was like 5 seconds before it came up with, you will not be able to continue streaming.
So that's what we should do for the 6:30 game, right? We should set the turn timer to 5 seconds like that video.
That would be
horrible. It would be riots.
I think it was 5 seconds and also marathon speed.
Yeah.
You know what would be an even crazier thing is if they had an option for the AI to automate any moves that you didn't make when the timer expires.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
To make a move, and then any other moves, the AI will do them for you.
I'm not sure if that's like, better or worse.
So not only do you not have time to make decisions, but you have to actively fight against the AI making bad decisions.
But like, you have so little time with 5 seconds that if you have like more than a few cities, it might be better in a lot of cases to do nothing rather than do something rather than nothing. So like, it might actually help you, just because otherwise your cities would sit idle. Then you can like micromanage like a couple units and still have some level of productivity going on behind you, even if it's horribly optimized and awful. It's better than just like literally picking nothing in the queue, I think,
right?
Oh, man. Maybe? We could start a whole new challenge series for Civ Fanatics. The 5-second turn timer challenge. Beat Deity on 5-second turn timer.
Oh, my God. You might be able to do it with the diplomatic stuff, maybe.
I don't think so.
Spiffing Brit did it with the Maori by just parking in a corner somewhere and getting the diplomatic points.
Yeah, but he needed more than 5 seconds per turn to manipulate all the diplomacy.
Yeah, for the first few turns at least, and then at the very end of the game. But for the most of the game, he just hit and turn and turn and turn.
I mean, I think it would just be hard because the game doesn't have, like, it does not accept inputs fast enough. Like, even if you could, in principle, be like a 300 APM StarCraft 2 player optimized to input stuff into Civ 6 as quickly as humanly possible, like, the game will slow you down. Like, you cannot... There's no input buffering. There's nothing like that. So you can't, like, queue up 100 moves in those 5 seconds or whatever, or 300 moves in those 5 seconds, and then, you know, like, have the game execute them all before the timer runs out. It just runs out.
There is some...
on the number of possible orders you can make.
There is some input buffering, but not enough.
It's inconsistent input buffering. It's the worst kind.
Yeah.
Because, I am no, like, pro StarCraft player. But even I in Civ 6 run afoul of inconsistent input buffering because sometimes it'll buffer your inputs and sometimes it won't do them when you're assuming it will because it inputted them previously or buffered them previously. And that's a bad place to be in because then you can't trust it. So you're forced to sit there and watch to make sure what you ordered happens. So you wait a little longer than you would otherwise, which only slows you down further.
I know I have this issue where a lot of times it will because I don't know how to describe it. I'm not sure exactly what's happening, but sometimes when I move my hand to do something with the mouse, like, there's some sort of weird input that happens. I think it's my finger not properly releasing or something. But I'll find out that it's like, oh, the mouse actually clicked when I didn't want it to click. Or I let go of it when I wasn't planning on it, and it will just take the input. And then I'm sitting here 10 turns later. Why is my unit on the other side of the world? Civ is really a game I probably shouldn't play.
Oh, yeah. I think stuff like that will happen if you, like, accidentally, like, click and drag into, like, the fog of war or something like that.
Oh, yeah,
And then the unit tries pathing around the entire world because there's, like, it knows that there's, like, a mountain or something in the way, but you don't know that. Or there's a unit on that tile. So it, like, decides to take the long way around.
Yeah. But, yeah, Civ is probably not a game that I should try to play effectively with my current problems, but...
Well, if it makes you feel any better... If it makes you feel any better, the fact that, like, the rest of us even recognize the problems that you're talking about means it's problems for other people, too.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, speaking of Hearts of Iron and this unit selection, like, you can select units on screen with the drag box and then click to move, and somehow the game selects units that are not on screen. I do not understand how the f*** their coding is, but that happens, like, every time I play it, without exception. It reliably will select units that are not on screen when I use a drag box. Like, I don't understand. I don't even understand what kind of programming incompetency leads to that.
This is
the only time I've ever observed that in a game.
I have an idea, but it's still very, very bad that no programmer should ever leave in a product. The idea is that you draw the box with the mouse, and for some reason, the programmer doesn't have the two lines of code required to bind the box to the screen, so it will, like, keep drawing the lines that you have indicated beyond the edge of the screen and select any unit that just happens to be in the way.
But, like, the box is fully contained on the screen.
Yeah, but the vectors aren't limited, because when you draw a box on the screen, all four of the lines of the box get drawn mathematically across the entire screen and the entire digital space, and you're supposed to bind the boxes twice, first by where the actual edge of the line is and where the edge of the screen is. That way you don't end up with weird anomalies like this. And if you don't bind them on the edge of the screen, sometimes you'll end up with, like, if the for some reason it goes into the negative and the programming code is just bad, it will register areas that it shouldn't as active and collect them.
I see.
So,
because, yeah, I haven't been able to discern a pattern for which units get selected off screen, but maybe that wouldn't be discernible if it's the issue you're describing.
it sounds like, based on what Canis is saying, that it would always be units that are to the right or bottom of where you're dragging the box. Because you probably... can you drag the box in any direction, or do you have to drag from top left to bottom right?
You can start from any direction and drag it either way.
Okay, then in that case, it would be units in whatever direction you're dragging towards. So if you start your click at the bottom right corner of the box and then drag up and to the left, then if I'm understanding Canis correctly, what would happen is units that are further to the left off the screen or further up but off the screen might also get included in that vector space.
That is possible.
Yeah. I mean, that's possible.
But
I haven't noticed.
If it's a bug process, which it clearly is, then there could be other things that are affecting it as well. Like maybe it will only pick up the first unit it sees in that area, and then it will realize, oh crap, I'm in the wrong place, and then just take that unit and add it to the rest. That's one way that could happen. Theoretically, if it's got both vectors that aren't cut off at the end, it could try to extrapolate where the edge should be and then draw a line between them. There are a lot of ways that bugs happen, which is why it's really hard to figure out why some bugs happen.
Well, and Phil, I only played Hearts of Iron 4 very briefly, but if I remember correctly, like units, when you build units, they're like deployed into armies already, and then they like leave where they're built, and then they go to join the army. So is it possible that what's being selected is something that's in like the same army as the units you're trying to select? So it selects them as well, but they're just on their way to joining the army. So it's
not a chance.
Okay.
The way you select army groups is not.
Since you're not too familiar with the game, it'd be hard for me to explain to you. But there's a frontline mechanic, and then there's a micromanagement mechanic. I'm talking about specifically scenarios where I've drag-clicked a specific number of units, and I'm trying to right-click them into enemy territory in a way that the game will not move them willingly otherwise. So no chance that an automatic deployment would path that way. Because unless I execute an attack order, there's no chance that the game should automate an attack into their territory at all. Now, there are some other bugs that result in that, but they have green arrows rather than red arrows. You know, the game doesn't update pathing on front lines, but based on frontline changes, and it will make units that are not assigned to an attack order attack into territory. I don't think that should be considered working as intended either. It's clearly nonsense, but
it's terrible.
It's a different kind of issue.
So I'm curious, are Hearts of Iron 1 through 3 also like really bad, or were those like really good games and it's just 4 that for whatever reason is broken beyond repair?
4 is the first one I played, so I have no idea. But my impression is that you didn't have the ability to have all these automated things happening in the earlier games. So they were micro hell, but because they didn't have this kind of stuff implemented, they were only micro hell, so to speak.
Yeah, I have heard that the earlier Hearts of Irons are really good, and that 4 is the worst. And I've also heard that 4 is okay, and I've also heard that 4 is only good with mods.
4 has some fun elements, but some of its design stuff is like subjectively bad, and some of its design stuff is objectively bad, in that it does not accomplish what the developers stated was the intention for the mechanic, and it isn't close either.
Well, it is Paradox, and they have like 10-man teams, so it's working. Is it working as intended? No. But is it working? Most of the time. Well, then ship it.
It's also not working. I'm sorry, but no. It's uniquely bad even for Paradox games that I've played. Now, I haven't played Stellaris. I haven't played Vicky 3. I've like barely touched Vicky 2. I haven't touched Imperator Rome at all. So maybe those are equally bad. But among the Paradox games that I've played, Hearts of Iron stands far above the others in terms of the issues with it, both objective and subjective issues. And the ones that bother me, those are the objective issues. Things like the game telling you that something will happen and then it doesn't happen, or that you need this requirement to do that and that's not actually true. Either you meet the requirement and don't get it anyway, or you actually don't need that requirement to get it in the first place. Or you have things like air traffic control or weather/air accident controllers, and you can hire them and they actually do nothing in the code. There's all kinds of things like that, which just don't have near the sheer volume of issues in other games in their lineup.
Also,
and on top of that, its UI is by far the worst by a margin. It is a complete joke, and I don't think anybody who has any sense of pride in their work should have let the game ship in that state. It's that bad from a UI perspective. It lies to you, it fights you in the controls, and they deliberately made it worse in taking away the player option to micro in the first and then penalizing it as a trade-off instead.
When they got called out for it.
Yeah.
What? You mean you don't like our automated crap? Well then, get screwed.
Yeah, we're going to intentionally take away your ability to micromanage it and retain planning bonus because we want you to use our mechanic that doesn't work. But we're not going to fix that mechanic that doesn't work. You can't even spearhead properly using the spearhead order because spearhead units will do supporting attacks to help the units that are attacking enemies to pin to allow the spearhead to execute. And there's like, oh my gosh, there are fanboys who actually defend that as a functionality. It's unreal. Like, that's not what the word spearhead means in English, and I don't think the Swedish equivalent implies it either. Yeah, whatever.
I liked Stellaris, at least until they removed all the FTL options other than the Piper lanes.
I heard that they were, like, completely imbalanced, though, to the point where you had to use, like, only one of the options because it was just so much better than the other ones.
That was, yeah. I mean, but I wasn't playing it at a high enough level to, you know, for that to have been a problem for me. So I don't know how legitimate the complaints were, but I liked the other FTL methods. Like the hyperlanes one was to me like the least interesting because it's also like the one that every other Space 4X does.
Yeah.
There's a reason why every other Space 4X does it.
I mean, apparently I suppose that is the case, but there was also a really good Star Trek mod for Stellaris that I played for a while. Until the, you know, removal of the warp drive mechanic kind of broke it.
Vicky 3 isn't even out yet, and people have already decided it's a terrible game.
Paradox's track record lately hasn't been great with new releases, but who knows?
Well, it did get leaked and discovered to be a pile of crap.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't care about it enough to look into it, but my impression from players who like Vicky was that it did not look good to them.
You can't declare war. Or
at all?
Where I think you can, but you don't control any of your own units on the map, so you have no real agency over it.
So yeah, I guess then your entire agency is going to be on the economic management side of things and to some degree diplomacy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some people's cup of tea, though.
I can understand, but you can't make a game about world history where war is forbidden. You just can't.
Well, you're not saying that it's forbidden. You're saying you can't control the units. Those are two different propositions.
I'm not even sure units appear on the map.
Even so, if your history-based game is emphasizing the diplomatic and economic side of things deliberately, I mean, that's not necessarily invalid. It's not to my preference, but...
But how much teeth do diplomatic actions have if you don't have the threat of war to back certain diplomatic actions up?
Well, you do have the threat of war. It's just that the game isn't letting you micromanage the units. It's just deciding on the outcome based on dice rolls or whatever it's doing. But, like, it's still a threat in that if you don't adequately build up your nation to be more capable, then you're going to lose. Unless you trick the AI into, like, hug-boxing with you or something. I mean, people have done EU4 runs with no units and have made substantial headway that way. So it's not completely impossible, but generally speaking, it's not the way you want to approach the game, usually.
General rule, you don't take the war out of a game that has the subtitle Expansion Diplomacy... what was it? Expansion, Diplomacy, Economy, War?
I don't know what it does.
I don't either, but all I know is that nobody who thought they were going to like Vicky 3 actually does. So, and it's not even out yet.
I wonder if maybe the version that was leaked was maybe some, like, alpha or something that just doesn't have all those mechanics implemented yet.
No, these things, I haven't actually looked at the leak. All I know is what they said in the dev diaries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the dev diary said, we aren't letting you control your armies. Oh, well, that's what they get for putting Wiz the Wiz in charge of it. I mean, he's the one who designed Stellaris such that they had to completely redesign the whole thing afterwards. Why would he do any better with Victoria 3, which is the one all your fans are really, really wanting?
Well, some people can get better over time, but I don't have much faith in Wiz in particular.
Well,
he has earned a lot of disrespect from me. Uniquely among Paradox employees, like for all the disagreements I've had with Johan over the years, like he's improved, I've improved as a person in arguing with him, and like the games he's overseeing now seem better to me than they were like 8 years ago, for example.
Like he's actually a game designer who learns from the stuff he does.
Yeah,
he's a good game designer, which is probably why his company is big, because, you know, even if we don't agree with somebody, their success can tell us that other people maybe are okay with that, and they at least have an idea of what they're doing. But Wiz Wiz's arguments are like, you're wrong because I said the word means this, or things like, you're wrong because you're wrong.
Yeah, he does that all the time.
Like, could you give me some supporting evidence to your statement? Banned. Now, we have another topic we could do, but it's also very late in the show, so why don't we just go ahead and call it off? I'll come back to it next week when we have no other topics.
Like Candace is saying, get out.
No.
Sure. At least then I'll be able to actually watch the video.
Both videos, actually.
Yeah.
Homework. You mean all three?
What do you mean all three? Where's the third one?
Oh, we got an interview with Soren Johnson about Old World. Oh, yeah.
That was on the list, but because we already had one from last time, I didn't add it.
Yeah.
Sounds like we got a lot of homework for 2 weeks from now, then.
I mean, I already watched the GDC one, but oops, spoilers.
All right, well, stay tuned for 2 weeks from now when we will be talking a lot about
game design,
video interviews and game design and stuff like that. It'll be loads of fun. But in the meantime, this has been Polycast episode 403, and I have been one of your regular co-hosts, Mega Bears Fan, joined as always by Canis Albinus.
Protect your brain. You'll never get it back.
Makalua.
Come back next time for our own mini GDC, I guess.
And the Mian team.
Don't get caught in the TMIT disaster.
Thanks for listening.
I can't imagine what a TMIT disaster would be.
Is it worse than having Grimbeck start next to you as Nubia? Also in a PvP game?
In a PvP game, I don't think there's anything worse. Except maybe Grimbeck starting next to you as Sumeria.
Yeah, I don't know what between those two, which I'd rather try to defend with, like, starting units.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, 6, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.